The Short Game is listener-supported on Patreon. If you'd like to support the show and join us on our Discord, head to theshortgame.net or patreon.com/theshortgame. Welcome back to The Short Game. This is a show about short video games, games that respect your time. I'm Reagan Kelly, and I'm joined this week by two fantastic co-hosts.
Nate Heininger.
And Shane Kelly.
And this week we are talking about Terra Nil. The Earth may not be healing in the real world, but we can always imagine.
What are video games for, but, you know, nice escapism.
The true power fantasy, the power to reverse all this shit.
Yeah, actually, so this was a game that has been recommended to us a number of times in the Discord and keeps coming up, and it had been very, very appealing to me. One, as a sort of a long-time fan of the sim-like games, which I think we're going to talk about here in a minute, your Sim Cities and your various tycoons. But what really appealed to me about this game was that premise, that this is sort of the inverse of those games, that instead of building a massive industrial complex or, you know, some sort of amusement park or whatever, you're actually breaking that down and returning the world to a bit of a environmental stasis. And that just seemed really, really compelling to me, and enough people recommended it. And I haven't really engaged in a sim-like game for quite a long time, because they are often sort of the antithesis of this show's entire premise.
Unfortunately, yes.
But this game, you're taking a sort of a destroyed environment and returning it to a beautiful piece of nature, and then you're done. There is actually like an end state for each stage, and it ultimately makes it a pretty manageable short game. So that entire like package, I thought, was incredibly appealing for something for this show, and I think why it has been recommended to us a lot.
Yeah, and just in terms of the, you know, how long to beat on this, like, you look up something like, yeah, maybe I should have. I didn't look up, like, how long to beat on, like, SimCity 2000 or something like that, but I'm sure it's, you know, at least dozens of hours.
Beating SimCity 2000?
Yeah, I'm not even sure. But Terra Nil is a main story, 5 hours, main story plus side, 8 on how long to beat. So, like, obviously, right in our strike zone.
Yeah, there might be
stretching it a little bit. I mean, how much
there is a credit scene in this game, which I was able to get to in a pretty reasonable time.
I just checked SimCity 2000, 22 hours on how long to beat, which I don't know how accurate that is, because I'm sure there's not a lot of people speed running SimCity 2000 to record their play times on how long to beat anymore. But you know, given a bit of a ballpark, this is clearly like a much more tailored experience, and I think that is sort of the key thing of it, is like, the whole idea here is you go in, you restore nature, and then you leave no trace, you know, you're leave only footprints kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's something that no other game in this genre that I've ever seen kind of does.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's a complete inversion or subversion of the story or structure of most of the games in the sim genre. You know, the games there are mostly about starting off from nothing, a natural wild paradise, and slowly expanding your urbanization across the map. And a lot of games have done some sort of subversion of the kind of the pattern there. Every game in the sim genre has kind of a built-in internal politics or ethos to it, which is one of the things that's really fascinating about it. You know, they have some perspective on you know, what good urban policy looks like or something like that. And Terra Nil has a really firm stance that humans are bad.
we need to get out of here.
There's a phase to this where, you know, you start off in a kind of a apocalyptic wasteland, essentially. And you are building up these structures that are things like solar power plants or wind power generators and things that will help you get rivers going, things like that. And all of it is to the end of rebuilding the environment and creating a place for, you know, plants and animals to thrive. And then that third phase of the game, there's like kind of building it up, managing things. And then there's the third phase where you are basically packing up and disassembling all of the buildings that you've created in order to help restore the wildlife and using the material from that to build a airship to pack it all out with you and leave behind you like a perfect natural wilderness, which it would kind of be hilarious to have, like, you finish packing it out and then immediately, like, SimCity 2000 starts and it's like, let's cut these trees down. They're great. We use these to build.
Thanks for planting these trees and reintroducing all of these wild boar. Now we have food and lumber.
It's interesting. Before we get into talking about the mechanics, which are sort of, you know, this is a very mechanical game, like all sort of city builder type of games. For me, there's very rarely been a game where there's more of a bit of a mismatch between the sort of like mechanical side and the theme. Not to say that like it doesn't work. This is a well-designed game with a clever kind of merging of these two ideas. But like, I think that that idea of this sort of like, you know, post-disaster, apparently, because the world looks like trash, like, you know, ecological, like, just sort of the, like, the theming of this is almost moving. It's like, it's really beautiful to see this idea of, like, we're going to go in and, like, you know, rebuild nature and leave no trace. And it's really, truly, like, a beautiful idea. And also, this is a very mechanical game, and not all of the mechanics really worked for me. So, like, kind of a weird tonal thing for me.
Yeah.
But I got to say, like, theming-wise, I was actually, like, more into it than I expected. I thought it was kind of moving.
Yeah, there's a lot that this game does that I think is all about trying to evoke that that feeling. I do agree to some, even though I ultimately, like, really loved this game, there are some mechanical things that I found a bit clunky and whatnot, but we'll dig into all that through this conversation. But broadly speaking, the like tone and attention to detail on the appreciation of nature, I thought really, really stood out and was done really well. And they there's tons of little objectives in this game, and the reward, generally speaking, for most of the objectives is just like a nicer looking landscape. And I really like that. It took me a little while to sort of realize the like incentive structure of this game really is just like, you'll just make your world a little more beautiful if you stretch for this extra goal. And that ended up working for me. And I loved going for the extra goals just to make the world a little bit more beautiful. And they really, I think, top that off by when you do complete all the main objectives and you're ready to pack up and leave this part of the world and go to the next, you have two options, which is continue or appreciate. And if you select appreciate, you just get to sort of zoom in around on the map and, you know, and look at your nature's splendor before moving on. And ultimately you, I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, you're ultimately leaving the entire planet. I get the sense that like at this point in, you know, I guess it's not even necessarily humans that are doing this. You don't ever see you don't ever see who sort of
could be
charge.
Could be our robot children. You know, you only ever see their like airships and machines.
Yeah, where you're going and you're basically reintroducing flora and fauna to this burnt out landscape that at least at some point had humanoid occupants. And then you're leaving the planet entirely, which is pretty cool. And yeah, that's like that whole vibe, that entire concept was, I think, the most appealing thing to me and really the highlight of the game. Before we go like too far into the game, though, I don't think we've done like a sim game in the now 10 years which we talked about it on our 400th episode, but we have now crossed the threshold. Happy 10 years.
Congrats, Reagan, everyone.
Shane,
happy
Laura,
anniversary to all of you.
Yeah. Well done. More back padding, please.
Yes. Is this the one? What is 10 years? Do we have to like buy each other diamonds or something like that?
I looked this up and it's aluminum.
Aluminum. Oh, cool.
So I have some new MacBook Pros for you.
That's
here,
what I was
going
to say. Yeah. Send me a MacBook. I'll take it.
No, those are titanium now.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. But anyway, I don't think we've done, I can't think of a sim game that we've done.
Yeah. The closest I could think of are things like, Game Dev Story, which is kind of a sim game, but it's really more sort of like it's a little more choose your own adventure-y, right?
Yeah. That's a good one. That's pretty close to in the genre. So this is, I think, the first of the like sort of, it's a your isometric grid, and you're using your resources to build things, to gain more resources to build more things and et cetera. Yeah. I don't know, one of the oldest genres in video games, arguably, and something that like is massive, but we just never do because they're generally endless.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say A Dark Room was kind of a sim game in some ways.
There's a little bit of
I can see it.
I think there are sim, a lot of the games that we've covered obviously have sim inspiration. Mm-hmm. But we have not been anywhere.
Not in the same way that this genre is.
This is just a straight up, like, I mean, obviously it's sort of an inversion of the entire city builder genre, but it has so many of the aspects of the city builder genre. So it has the perspective was the thing that really struck me at first. Like, you don't really think about, nature on a isometric grid, right? Like, you don't think of like, this is my trees square,
my
or
deciduous
something.
Tree tile next to my lagoon tile.
Exactly. So that actually struck me as a little odd, the little like, my rivers are all going to be perfectly rectilinear and so on. Good. I mean, this is an argument in favor of the robot hypothesis here. They're rebuilding nature, but they literally cannot build a rounded rectangle. Everything is a square.
Yeah. Did you guys play, like, I know you all have been computer gamers forever, this genre has dominated PC gaming and Mac gaming to some degree for so long. So I think especially the 90s when the sim games were everywhere. Like, I loved Sim Ant, played a ton of Sim Ant, Sim City 2000. What was your background with it?
Let's see. What did we play a lot of, Shane? We were Mac kids.
Mm-hmm. We did have SimCity 2000.
Access. Yeah, I think that really the one, the two were like, I played a fair amount of the original SimCity on a black and white Macintosh. At some point, I think my dad brought home a diskette of that. I don't think we had the manual or the box or anything. It might have been pirated, like everything was back then. But I played a lot of like original SimCity, and later when we had color Macintoshes, we got SimCity 2000, I think, right, Shane?
Yeah, that was, we ended up playing a lot of that game.
Mm-hmm. And I think in a way that was kind of the Minecraft of its day. It's not like it was like, and specifically what I mean is that like it had multiple ways to play. Like, you could play sort of like missions, you could like load up a city and it would tell you like, hey, you've got to fix the tax code in Birmingham, Alabama in 7 years or something like that. And like, that's fine.
Can think of nothing more exciting.
I know. And then, you'd have like sort of additional goals of like, and in some way it had a little bit in common with this. It had this, the like 2000 had the arcologies where like, once you built your city up to be like perfection, right? You could build these arcologies and move all of your people into them and then blast them off into space and leave Earth behind, which was a cool idea, but it was kind of an end state for the game. There was no next step there. But, I think what we ended up playing mostly was like, you could use cheat codes, which why wouldn't you? I was a kid, and you could just throw Godzillas at your city or whatever.
Yeah,
and
tornadoes, like, etc.
Yeah, yeah. And that was the really cool thing to do in SimCity, and that's why I kind of think of it as being kind of like the Minecraft of its day. Is like, it had sort of both creative mode and more like survival mode, I guess. You know, and we were very much in the creative mode, like infinite money, cheat, build the wildest city, then throw Godzilla at it, etc. kind of vibe, I think. Mm-hmm.
I remember really loving Sim Life. So we did have we did have the original Sim City on our earlier Macintoshes. And it was cool. It was obviously a fantastic game. Sim City Classic is amazing. And when we had that one, it came with a game that I really loved, which was Sim Life. You get those as like a package deal. And Sim Life was kind of the similar to this. It was the concept was simulating an ecosystem. But in that, you had a very direct hand in the ecosystem. Here, in Terra Nil, it's about creating space for the ecosystem and you know, kind of clearing things out. In Sim Life, you would directly modify the genetics of the plants and animals in the world to the point where you could create kind of anything. The cover of the box had, like, a kangaroo with a lizard's tail and a toucan head on it. Yes. And that was a big part of the game. There was a part of that game that I absolutely loved where you could make a creature in two different ways. One was just sort of, it had a like a D&D character sheet where you could add and remove traits from it, right? And the other was you could basically mix and match a head, a body, and a tail. And you achieved the same result, but it was way more fun to just kind of make a crazy creature that way. So that game, my overwhelming perception of Sim Life was that the ecosystems were incredibly precarious. Like, in order for the ecosystems in Sim Life to work, you had to have lots of interdependent creatures that perfectly balanced each other very well. And if you're just messing around and creating a weird, like, toucan head thing, it was very easy for you to mess it up. I do remember one time playing that game where I was like, you know, I was messing around with the plants. The plants weren't as fun to modify as the animals. but I created what was basically grass 2.0. And nice. Grass 2.0 was a real grower. It would take over. And it would take over the entire map incredibly rapidly and choke out all other plants. And I was like, yes, I finally made a plant that grows. But it would destroy every world that you would put it in. so, you know, that was the kind of, like, sim that it was. There hasn't really been a game much like that. I guess there was Spore. I did enjoy Spore. Spore might be considered
this kind of genre. But even that was, that's still 2008. Mm-hmm. I was just looking that up because that's what made me think of that. And Spore, you know, I know there had been games before that had this sort of hype cycle, but to me, that's one of the biggest.
Mm-hmm. Spore was unbelievably disappointing.
Yeah. You know, it was like, it had a very similar feel to like what ultimately happened to No Man's Sky as well, where like the first like 3 hours of it feel like incredible, one of the coolest games that has ever been made, and then you realize that it just doesn't quite go anywhere. And Spore was ultimately pretty disappointing. But making your little guys, love making the little guys, seeing what they look like, but it ultimately collapsed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's one game. This isn't even really all that recent. But within the time frame that we've been podcasting, there was one sim game that I got very, very into. That was a game called Banished. I did talk about it on the podcast at one point. Yeah. Did any of you guys end up trying
that
or playing it?
No, I think I downloaded it at one point, but I kind of bounced off.
Yeah, Banished falls into kind of a weird subgenre of the sim game where it's sort of a colony sim. You land with a few kind of people on your new kind of landmass, and you're trying to create a self-sustaining colony. And it has a lot of differences from the sort of things like SimCity that you might be used to. It's about a 10-year-old game at this point. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how worth it is to check out today. I have thought about going back to it. The resource in that game is not like money or taxes or, you know, or really much in the way of materials. Your resource really is the people, because you know, they have their own life cycle. You know, they grow, they live, they die, they multiply, and in that game, all of the other resources are being physically moved around and carried around by the people. So, you know, if you're going to build a building, the people are going to be gathering the resources and building it and stuff. And in fact, everything has to be moved around. A great deal of the effort in that game, a chunk of your population just has to be dedicated to moving resources from, like, you know, where they're gathered to a storage area to where you're building things. I found it to be a really relaxing game. But like a lot of these sim games, you know, it really shows you the precarity of any really complex system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that winter hits and you start running low on food and, you know, the trade caravan comes in late or something and it has a massive, you know, lethal effect on your population.
Yeah. Or if the velocity of your cart on your roller coaster is too high for that little incline, you may send your entire group of unsuspecting patrons flying into their untimely deaths. I played an absolute ton of Roller Coaster Tycoon and will forever have a place in my heart for that game and Zoo Tycoon, which I think fit into this genre as well. The entire, I think, like, it seems to me the sim genre is pretty alive and well, though there's not a lot of games like this one that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. The City Skylines is huge, although if I understand there's some controversy with the second one right now. There's Planet Coaster, Planet Zoo. You know, these games are still being made and still being, seems to be very, very successful. I think even like The Sims is still running, but they just don't fit this show for obvious reasons. They are
The Sims is like still fully thriving. Like that's an enormous community around those games.
Yeah, I would love to check out Banished at some point. I remember when that came out. Like this is another one of these. This entire genre for me, at least, is the same thing that I think of, like Stardew Valley and stuff. I know I would absolutely love them, but I just, you know, I don't want to commit what will likely be hundreds of, you know, I've got to still play Slay the Spire. I've got to still play FTL. I've got to still, you know, dip into Hades. I don't have time for these sim games too.
Nate, I'm going to pitch you card-based roguelike city builder.
Oh shit. Can we add like a dance rhythm element to it too, and just bring the whole thing together, or a platformer in it somehow, and you've got my game.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Reagan, you've basically just described the board game Dominion.
I mean, yeah, you're not wrong.
Yeah. You know.
Okay, so let's talk about the mechanics of this game. And I'll kind of preface this by saying I'm mostly going to be like letting Nate talk and listening on this part, because I kind of bounced off this one. I should probably mention this game is out on a bunch of different platforms. What did you guys play on?
I played it on Steam. They brought it out as this is one of the Netflix games. So
yeah, I also played the iPad version of this, which is free if you have a Netflix subscription, which is a kind of a nice plus. Like I haven't played a ton of those Netflix games, but you know, it's not like I'm getting rid of my Netflix subscription. And some of those games have been kind of interesting. They've been putting some money into making, you know, basically like acquiring the mobile rights to notable indie games. And this was one of those. And so when we decided to play this game, I was like, oh, sweet. I'll just download it on my iPad and play it there. And I'm not sure how much that contributed to this problem for me and how much it is just my personal, like, I bounced off this. I mean, this is not really my genre. But, yeah. Like, I had a lot of trouble with the interface on this game. Part of it, I think, is because this game was designed for PCs where you have, like, a mouse over hover state, and that doesn't exist on the iPad. But also just, like, I don't know, I couldn't, like, I don't know. I found it kind of difficult to get into. This game ended up feeling a little bit like homework for me in terms of its mechanics.
Yeah.
But I'd like to hear Nate sort of describe it a little bit, and because I think there's probably stuff that I missed or didn't understand correctly. Nate, would you please like walk us through how do you restore the Wasteland?
Yeah. So I'll say first, I played on laptop. I played it on Steam on my Mac, and I made abundant use of the sort of hover over tooltips. And so I don't quite know how that works on iPad. I assume you can just tap on it, but you know, there were bits and pieces that I found to be a little obtuse on how they work, and it took a bit of sort of finagling to make it work. That said, like, a lot of people in the Discord were talking about how fun this game is to play with their kids. So I don't know if it's just...
Shane said the same.
It was, you know...
I agree. In fact, it's worth mentioning, there are different levels of difficulty in here. There's like a... I forget what they call them, but one of them was like... just nature loving baby mode. So I played most of the playtime I had on this was playing with my son in nature baby mode. And he really liked it. So the kids today are very well aware of like the importance of ecology and stuff like that. So he really liked that aspect of it and loved like, you know, building a nice ecosystem. Also, kids just love games where you tap to, like, build stuff. I don't know what it is. They just like it. That's a whole thing. He's already been suckered into pay-to-play, like, terrible iPad games before. This was a big improvement on those in that respect. He had a lot of, like, he was teaching me a lot of the tips as we went through some of the phases. Like, he'd figured out how to... you know, find the animals and things like that. So definitely enjoyed seeing him kind of lock in on a game in this genre. Yeah. It's a lot more complicated than a lot of the games he plays.
I'm shocked he was able to, like, I know I was playing on a higher level of difficulty or whatever, but I'm shocked that he was able to, like, work it all out. I know he's you know, he's got decent reading skills, right? But, like,
yeah.
Like, I think this is a game that, like, I had to really read. It has, like, an in-game codex. I had to really page through that thing to sort of even figure out what my goals were. And I mean, I'm really surprised that a young kid
was playing it in this game. Baby mode, like I said. But you know, yeah, and I think it gives you a lot of guidance there. But he's a decent reader, so he was reading through the in-game thing, trying to understand what each little piece was.
Yeah, I think that's pretty cool. And echoed by the Discord, multiple people said they have played this game with their kid and it's gone really well. So I'll try to walk through it. I mean, there is kind of a lot of individual pieces to this game and little interlocking systems and whatnot. So I don't want to get too much in the weeds, pun intended.
I mean, the wildflowers, the native plants.
But the game has four primary regions. There's like a, you know, a grassland area, a polar area, more of like a desert area, and a abandoned cityscape area. And when you enter into them, they are almost entirely covered by pollution. All of the land is covered by toxicity, and you have three main meters. That sort of tell you a little bit about the environment. You have the overall temperature, you have the humidity, and then you have its radioactivity. And a number of objectives come down to how you basically balance those three things to bring back the overall the stasis of the environment. And so when you land or when you start, your first job is to clean up as much of the surface level toxicity as possible. And you do that by first creating a power source. There's some cool different ways to do that. Like Shane said, it might be you're dropping like wind turbines. It might be one of the cooler ones is you're actually like erupting fissures in the ground to create lava pools. And then you create a... I forget what it's called, but a
geothermic.
Yeah, like a geothermic system that sits on top of the lava and provides power in a grid space. And then you branch out from your core center of power dropping these toxic scrubbers, which each have a grid that clean up the toxicity and turn it into just soil. And then you will drop some degree of like an irrigation system that basically turns the now cleaned soil into like greenery, you know, grassland or some equivalent for that biome. There's water all throughout this. It all starts polluted, but that toxic scrubber also cleans up the water. There's a variety of systems that require water or built on the water or whatever. And so you have like some main goal right out of the gates that's just like clean up 90% of the surface area, which kind of feels like a lot, but once you kind of understand how the things click together, it's not too hard to clean up clean it up and basically build a world for you to start actually establishing your environments. From there, you get a set of objectives to repopulate the area with like biome relevant like flora. So it'll be like like the greenery area, the more like deciduous area, you're trying to bring back like a deciduous forest. And in order to do that, you have to plant, you have to use this building on greenery while the temperature is above 2 degrees Celsius and the humidity is above, you know, X percent and whatnot. And if they aren't at those levels, there's some weather control buildings that you can build to like increase the temperature or decrease the temperature or whatever it may be. And so each of these buildings have a relevant set of specifics. Some can only be built on like rocks or on a cliff face or next to water or whatever it may be. And you're sort of mixing and matching these different buildings. Some of them require another building to be built first, and then you build this one on top of it. And, you know, this is where there's like, I don't know, like 100 different little sort of connections here that I honestly don't think I could even get too specific, even if I wanted to, even though I hit credits on this game like this morning and it already has sort of washed over me all the little specific interconnecting parts. But you're basically plugging together very, very specific tools to repopulate the world with these different types of environments. And then the final phase is you need to reinstitute animal life. And maybe collect seed samples or a couple different sort of objectives around like finalizing the biome. And then, as was mentioned before, you have to actually tear it all down, recycle everything, put it into an airship or a rocket ship and fly away. And then you get to appreciate your world. And there's a lot in there. There's a lot of little clicks, a lot of little like sometimes clunky. I agree with Reagan. Like I some of this, it really did take me like reading and like rereading and like looking at the requirements and trying to like find the exact right spot. Like, oh, this thing needs 8 tiles of pure ocean water and 8 tiles of ice sheet. But I don't have ice sheet, so how do I get ice sheet? Okay, I have to like reduce the overall world temperature by 4%. How do I? Okay, there's this building that can only be built next to other water, but it needs to have power. You know, so there's like a lot of this little stuff that really requires, at least, you know, to me, like a little finicky work. But I'd say once I got about to the second second region, the game really started to click for me, and I ultimately like really enjoyed it.
I guess I got through a lot of what you're describing there. If I have one like criticism of the game, it's that the phase you mentioned where you are packing it all up to go kind of didn't, I mean, it was never that fun for me. Like, I actually do not like that part of the game. And I understand it thematically, and I get it. But it kind of felt like a drag, almost like a punishment for having done well in the rest of the game. I don't know how I might change that.
I mean, I didn't mind. That's actually interesting, because like, that was one of the parts that I liked. Like, again, I didn't play as much of this as Nate, because I kind of bounced off it. I basically played through one complete, like, zone, you know? One world, or whatever you want to call it. One biome. And that biome for me was the introductory one where you're kind of in the wetlands
And one of the ways that you do that recycling is with little like drone ships that putter around in your rivers trying to get collect your materials. And I thought that was a really cool part of the game. I liked building little drones and then watching them, you know, busily, kind of like one of my favorite parts of the SimCity games was like, you know, you build like roads and then you get to see the traffic sort of, you know, go about its business on the roads. And that was sort of, that was sort of the same kind of joy with the little drone ships. So I liked that part. I found other parts more tedious, like
the thing that cracked me up about that world, Reagan, that was the first one I did too, and I totally just did not understand how anything works. So I'm just plopping buildings left and right, just plop, 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 you know, building things everywhere, and not knowing that like I'm gonna have to basically undo all of that with a system of connections. And on that one, everything has to be near your recycling thing is on water, so you have to have like everything kind of near a river. And I had like really just built everything so haphazardly that the best way I was able to solve like getting everything near a river was to just carve rivers across the entire world. Like
I did a bunch just too.
Just a ton of zigzag, massive rivers left and right across the entire world.
I think that's part of the issue that I had with it, because I was playing on Nature Baby mode with the kiddo, and we were extremely haphazard about where we placed everything, and you get exceedingly punished for that at the end in that mode. Cleaning up becomes real hard if you just scattershot stuff all over the map.
Punished. I think that's just that's a harsh word, because it's part of the whole point of the game. I did feel that a little bit on the first one, especially since it did. I felt it was so. It felt a little tedious to go through the process of undoing all of it. But that's where once I recognized that these sort of there's a bunch of temperature based temperature and humidity and toxicity based optional objectives that you can do, that I was kind of saying at the beginning that when you accomplish them, they just basically add more color and interesting elements to the world. So, you know, for example, it might be like with a temperature over 5 degrees Celsius, a humidity over 20 degrees and a toxicity below 40%, deer return to greenery. And if you accomplish that, now all your greenery spaces have like delightful little deer walking around. Or there was one where if you accomplish like a particularly harder set, you get the aurora borealis returns, and so you get this really interesting, like sort of shimmering lightscape over top the entire world.
There was an old scientific theory that went by the name spontaneous generation. It was the idea that like if you had a pile of dirt, you would just get rats there, or if you were a dirty dude, you would just get fleas in your hair. They would come out of nothing. And that's kind of how the life works.
That's kind of how it works in this game.
I found that whole system very confusing. It's like, use sonar pings to summon the birds or whatever. I'm like, from where, dude? They're all dead.
Yeah, you're identifying that they are there, not that you're... But yeah, I mean, it's all, you know, you only have to ask like one question of how this game works for the entire concept to fall apart. But
yeah,
you know, that's not the point.
Fair enough.
But once I started doing those things and populating and actually like filling the world with color, you know, it did make the sort of like extraction side of it. One, I just got better at it. So the extraction part really only takes a few minutes at the end when you know how it works. And if you've done everything, a lot of the optional stuff, you have added a lot of detail into the world, and getting rid of all of your big fat buildings, you know, really makes those things pop even more. And I ended up by the end, like really looking forward to sort of the deconstruction part of it. But yeah, at the beginning, I definitely felt like it was kind of tedious. I was like, oh, but I like my little my little, you know, irrigation system that I've built, and look how organized everything is, you know.
Can't the deer just walk around the turbine?
But that's that like world-destroying capitalist talking, right? Yeah. Oh, look yeah, how orderly right. my system is. Wouldn't it be great if it also belched gases into the atmosphere?
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How, good gases,
how
though.
Must it produce yes. me profit? I make I can't more get paper rid of clips. This. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, that's kind of ultimately the game is this, like, you know, sort of figuring out the puzzle of, how you bring about these different environments and reintroduce the wildlife and then take it all apart and ship it back into space. You know, the final one has you like collecting seed samples from all four of the biomes, which was similarly clunky. Like it wasn't particularly like a fun mechanic, but it was still interesting. You're like have the view scope through a satellite, you know, and you're like toggling through the worlds and scanning things with a satellite. That was fine, but you know, from like a fun perspective, but fit the vibe really well, I guess. And since this game is, you know, only a few hours, really, like it really connected with me. But I think, like, I would say if you aren't enjoying it, like, try to do at least two of the worlds before you, like, really make a decision on it. But I get it. Also, these games just aren't for everybody. Just the sim genre is kind
yeah,
of tricky.
Yeah, I think I wish I'd pushed through a little farther, because I do think probably if I'd gotten over some of the weird humps I was hitting with the first biome, that I probably would have enjoyed it by the time I got to the second. But it being a bit of a busy week, I just, you know, once I started hitting those roadblocks, something about this game, like part of it was that, you know, I was playing on the iPad, which is not actually my favorite device for playing games on. Part of it was this had this sort of like sleepy vibe and I was only playing it late at night. Part of it was that it's this, you know, sim genre that I, you know, it's not really my thing. And just like my brain just slid off of this game. I would like try to sit down and play it. And, you know, very shortly afterwards, I was like, time for sleep, time for bed. But I think most of that is a me thing. Like looking at the game, like I clearly see like how it works and that it does work and that it will work for a lot of people. And so if you do find yourself, like, if you do like that style of game, like the you know, city builder, especially if you know you like it in a way that's like, well, I remember playing SimCity 2000 once when I was, you know, seven, but more sort of like in a present and real way, then I think this is a really good one of these to try out, especially if you like the, you know, it's only going to maybe take you like 7 or 8 hours to do the whole thing potentially. So that's definitely something that we don't get to do these very often because short ones of them don't exist. It's nice to have one.
Yeah, though I guess we could argue the, you know, we do the roguelike games and, you know, you could argue that with a lot of these sim games, you can kind of start and stop however you want.
You but, could also argue that this is our podcast and we can do what we like with
that's
it.
That's a great point. But it does, it is not, like, I did really appreciate that there's four biomes, they have clear objectives, there's an end state for each one, and then there's credits. And then there is a, there's like a post-credits, you can keep playing this. There's more regions within the biomes and whatnot, which I'm probably gonna check out. But I did enjoy, like, there's a start and an end to this game, which the other ones there are not. You're just sort of going until you're bored with it.
So I think we totally recommend this game for folks who are into it. And I think you'll probably know if you're the sicko that's into this game, or maybe the like Zen ecologist who's into this game. You can find it on, I think all it's on Steam and iPad, and again, iPad, you can get it or iPhone. I believe there's also, like, you can download this on your phone as well.
I can't imagine either.
Like, it was hard enough to get around.
Is it on phone? Yeah. I was a little bummed when I paid like $15 for it. And then I found out that it was free on Netflix, but ultimately I'm glad that I did because I think this is a mouse game. You know, it just, I didn't have any of the struggles that you guys were talking about. I think if you played it on your laptop first and then wanted to play it on iPad, like, I think that would make a lot of sense. And I'm sure a lot of people have had a good time just straight native with iPad.
Yeah, I think my biggest issue with the iPad version specifically is that a lot of the elements that this game would normally have presented with a mouse over become a tap. And so every time you, like, for example, you got the bar at the bottom of your screen that represents your different buildings that you could construct, and you have to tap on them and it brings up like a whole interface for that building. And then you have to tap again to get information about what that building is, back out of that, tap again to place it. It was a lot of like nested levels of tapping in order to do things that I think would be a lot easier if you had like a mouse and a couple of buttons. Definitely, I think if this is something that you're really wanting to dedicate some time to, maybe try out that iPad version. It is essentially free with Netflix, but like, I think if I were really going to put more time into this, I would spend the money on the Steam version. All right, so we have a little bit of time left here. Do we have some time to talk about what's making us happy this week? All right.
Let's
start with Nate. Nate, what's making you happy this week?
Let me grab something real quick.
Oh, good. Good podcasting. He's going to show us something on camera. Audio listeners, F you.
Just like any good podcast, I have a gigantic box that I would like for you guys to see.
Oh, no. Listeners, he's holding up a box the size
of
like
a big box.
Two of those big cinder blocks you use for construction.
Hold up, that
and
is a
it
card
is Slay
game.
Slay the Spire, the board yes. game. No,
hell yeah.
Nate.
So I have participated in two Kickstarters in my life. One was the Toe Jam and Earl game from like
that
5 years
okay.
ago. It was fine. Yeah, it was. It was a faithful adaptation of an old game, and turns out that old game was also just fine.
The more I look back on it, the more I think actually it was fine. At the time, I remember feeling a little weirdly disappointed, but I think honestly that was just me hoping for some like new thing, and it was not that. It was just the old thing again on new systems, which was fine.
It was just the old thing again. Yeah. But anyway, this is the Slay the Spire board game that has been in construction for like 2 years now, and it finally arrived. And
we're getting Slay the Spire 2 right now, right?
Yes. Slay the Spire 2 was announced, which I was not expecting at all, and I'm obviously incredibly excited for. And I've yet to play the game, but what they've done, the board game, it just arrived. What they've done is they've made Slay the Spire, the video game, into what appears to be a very faithful representation via board game of an up to 4-player cool. co-op game. So now you can play by yourself, which is awesome. Although I almost never do that. I have a handful of games that are single player, and I rarely do that, but I might give it a crack with this one. But you can go up to 4, and I love that it's co-op. So you and your friends are now attempting to ascend the spire and slay the heart. And there's like a ton of stuff that I didn't think they were going to actually bother to do. Like the entire ascension system is in here. There's the fourth act and the heart system. It's like it's everything is in here. Now they've simplified a lot of things for board game purposes. Like most enemies have only a handful of HP, and your attacks do like 1 damage or 2 damage. Because there's now
makes a lot of
tokens
sense.
On things, and yeah, you know, it's every all the numbers have been significantly reduced for ease of use. I love a good board game, and board game quality, like the quality of the tokens, the chits, and everything has gotten like really important, I think, in modern gaming. And this game spared no expense. Instead of like a lot of games now have, you know, you have your player board when it's often just like a piece of cardboard. They've actually done these really nice matte. It feels like a mouse pad.
Green mat. One of the games that I bought recently had like a upgrade to get those, and it was such a nice upgrade. I am such a sucker for board games with really good bits. Did I talk about that that post-apocalyptic card game on this.
Yeah, Radlands.
Yeah,
Radlands. It's on my list now, too, because of your recommendation.
Yeah, get the one. If you like those neoprene mat, that looks like the one that came with the fancy version.
Yeah. Yeah, everything. It's just part of the it is just a it is a card game. But part of the reason the box is so big is that all the sort of accoutrements are really well crafted and they've given you ample space in the box. And this is the first time I've seen this with a board game. It actually came with a repacking guide in the box on how to put everything into the box. They also did something funny. When you opened it up, the very first thing at the top was a sticker that you can take and put over the rules to change the rules. Because my best guess is that they printed everything and it basically it's a balance change.
A patch.
It's basically a patch to the game that they fixed by printing a sticker that you literally apply over one of the game boards to change the rules permanently because that's a better balance. And I don't know, I thought that was pretty clever. It's honestly like, you know, way smarter than reprinting, you know, every single booklet or whatever. They just popped a sticker into the box and shipped it out. So I haven't played it yet. You know, I guess I may have a different opinion after playing it, but I don't think that I will. This game was very seemingly lovingly crafted and had a ton of people from Slay the Spire involved in its creation. So I'm pretty excited to give it a shot. I think I've got a day scheduled later this week where some of my board game friends are going to come
That's
over.
Awesome.
And we're going to play.
Well, let me know how that turns out because it seems like a fun time. And like, I think 4-player co-op is definitely like a good approach for something like that. I think it'd be a really fun 4-player thing to do. Well, I have a What's Making Me Happy this week that is a little bit, I don't know. I think you're all going to roll your eyes, but I've been on a kick upgrading my GameCube. I don't know why I just this is something I literally like months and months ago I bought some stuff to do this and then I just never had time and then I finally had some time to do it and I went a little nuts with it. I've had a GameCube for years. I think I bought it back when I was living in St. Louis, Nate. So I've had it like, you know, in my stuff, but I only had like a handful of GameCube games. And there have been for years various different ways to run homebrew and like copies of games and so on your GameCube, but it was never something I really did a whole lot of. I tinkered around with it, but it was always a little bit clunky. Anyway, a few years ago, there was a new development in the kind of moribund GameCube modding scene where somebody invented a new mod chip for the GameCube, as well as some interesting new adapters that are all really cheap, which was partly why I just like picked this stuff up, you know, and put it in a drawer and was like, I'll mess with this when I have some time. So if you have a GameCube, the thing to look for is there is a new mod chip called Pico Boot. You can buy a Pico Boot kit, which is basically not a special hardware. It's literally the Raspberry Pi Pico, which is like a $5 to $7 circuit board thing from the Raspberry Pi organization. It's not like an entire independent computer of its own. It's more like a little like project board, kind of like an Arduino. But somebody wrote software for this that you can, it's a really like 101 level soldering job. You basically wire about 5 wires from a Raspberry Pi Pico to various points on the motherboard of a GameCube. And then it will just boot into whatever software you tell it to boot into, including Swiss, which is a piece of software that's like a kind of a homebrew menu for the GameCube where you can run games from anything. So you can, you know, boot non-standard disks, but very excitingly, you can also boot games off of an SD card attached to the GameCube in any one of several ways. But the other thing that's kind of new is an adapter you can get called the SD to SP2 adapter, which basically uses one of the unused serial ports on the bottom of the GameCube and gives you a micro SD card slot that just sticks out the side of the GameCube in a way that almost looks stock. It's like really quite a nice setup. So the idea is that you install this mod chip and you get a little SD card slot in the side of your GameCube. You put some
GameCube ISOs on the SD card, pop it in, and you get a, you know, boots directly to a menu, and you can boot up your GameCube and play whatever game you want in a way that feels like a, almost like a modern console. And in addition to that, I was playing around with that, I was like, oh, this is great, but I can only do my GameCube over S video. What can I do? And so I picked up a Prism adapter, which is another sort of, it's from a company called Retrobit. There's actually a whole bunch of different folks that offer different adapters that use the GameCube digital video port on the back to give you, oh dear, hang on, 1 second. this is the worst time for this to happen. One moment.
Yeah. Well, I guess I could give my book reviews while he's gone, but maybe we should just wait.
Yeah, I guess let's just wait. That's.
It was not the handyman.
Okay. All right.
What was the last thing I said? Something along the lines of talking about the...
Dude, I didn't understand a word you said.
Oh, my God. Okay. All right. I'll wrap it up. Long story short, there's a ton of really good open source, pretty inexpensive stuff you could get for your GameCube now. I got a GameCube that boots ISOs off an SD card, does really flawless HDMI out. And also, I got this thing called a Blue Retro, which is a Bluetooth adapter, so you can use almost any Bluetooth controller with it. My GameCube controllers are a little old and kind of nasty, so you know, using like PlayStation controllers and stuff with it, and it's awesome. I've been playing a lot of specifically the Mr. Driller game for it is great, and also I've been playing some Skies of Arcadia, the Dreamcast version, or sorry, the port from the Dreamcast.
I'm looking forward to this because you brought this with you, the GameCube, mm-hmm. in a little cardboard box. We didn't actually get to play it, but we had all the kids together at my place after the zoo about a week ago, and we were getting ready to play some Mario Party. I am down for some Mario Party with the kiddos.
Yes.
There is a great lack of like big couch co-op party games for kids these days. And digging up the old GameCube stuff seems like the perfect way to address this. So thank you.
Yeah, I think it'll be fun. And my kids mm-hmm. love Mario, but they also can't really play it very well. So I was kind of hoping that something mm-hmm. like Mario Party would be their speed. We haven't actually had a chance to break it out for them yet. But I thought, you know, the GameCube controllers, they've got the big green button. You know, it seems like it's something that can bridge that gap for them maybe a little bit.
I totally think that'll work. So you should bring it back, and we'll get the kids into it, or I'll come up there with the kiddo.
Shane, what's making you happy this week?
Making me happy this week. I have a couple of book recommendations. I was on a streak of not finishing horror novels because I was in the mood for horror novels, and I ended up adding a ton of them to my Libby, pulling them in from the library one at a time. And I just had a string of really real duds. I have specific things that I'm not wild about in horror. Like, you know, if it's one, for example, that I did not finish was called Dead 11, which had a really promising start, but ended up being very boring because it was just a story of guy who wants to find things out, whose job is reporter, who goes to Creepy Island and interviews people and then never asks detailed questions just to keep it creepy. So it was okay, but I have had now two in a row real hits, so I'm going to throw out a couple of horror novel recommendations to you guys. So the first horror recommendation that I have is called Silver Nitrate by Silvia Moreno Garcia. Silver Nitrate is the story of first off, this one was apparently like a bestseller in the horror genre, and won some awards from Goodreads, I think. Really interesting setting and characters. It's a very much kind of in the trope, in the vibe of a Lovecraftian horror, where you have some creepy old books that are, you know, integral to the plot. But the main story, I mean, the story is all about a woman named Montserrat, who's a living in the 90s in Mexico, and is an audio editor for film and is a big horror movie buff. And she has a friend named Tristan, who, you know, they grew up together, and he's a soap opera star whose career is kind of floundering. And the the action of the film starts when Tristan introduces her to a horror director who created this sort of lost horror film that she had been very interested in. And that horror film is really the start and that sort of mysterious book trope of like the that style of horror. I won't spoil much about it because I think it's a fun story. But what I will say about it is that the characters are fantastic. Tristan is kind of an interesting character as an actor with kind of a lot of a, sort of a troubled past. But Montserrat is especially great because you don't see a lot of real curmudgeonly female leads. She is just an absolute she's a prickly individual in the best possible way. So I really recommend that book. It's not the like super scariest one, but if you like the genre, especially if you like horror films or you know, some of the kind of Mexican horror films, like you think about stuff like the Mexican Dracula from way back in the day, whether they filmed on the sets while at night while they were filming Dracula in the same sets in the daytime. There's just kind of a whole world to it that I thought was really fantastic, and the writing is great. And then the other book that I'm going to recommend to you is called A House with Good Bones.
Oh, by T. Kingfisher. I haven't read that one yet.
Yes. Mm-hmm. A House with Good Bones. This was a real short one. It was really fun. I would say this is more kind of a mix of, it's not like pure horror. It's more of a mix of horror and thriller and fantasy. And the thing that I also loved about this one is it has a fantastic female lead character. The lead character in this has is a, I forget what her job title is. She's the person who goes to archaeological digs and analyzes like the remains of insects that are found in like the food storage areas and stuff like that. She has a very specific archaeology job, and she also, it's written first person, so she's your narrator, and she is very funny. Like, that's something you don't get in a lot of horror, is a main character that is just uproariously funny. Even while they're dealing with something that's really horrifying. And she's kind of come home to her kind of childhood house. And really, it's sort of a ghost story. There's, her mother is really behaving strangely and afraid all the time. And at first she's thinking it's maybe some degenerative disorder. But it is, in fact, ghosts, right? So really, really fun story. Just a fun lead character. So yeah, I can't recommend those enough. I'm going to go on. Reagan, you said you had read Nettle and Bone, which is another T. Kingfisher book that got a lot of really great praise. So that's on my list.
I adore T. Kingfisher. She's really prolific. So there's a lot of books and not all of them are my taste. I tried her, her horror book that is sort of like a modern rewrite of the Fall of the House of Usher. I'm trying to remember the title of it now. I don't remember that one. But that one didn't quite do it for me. But Nettle and Bone is astonishing. It's like a very fun rework of sort of fairy tale concepts into a sort of more modern fantasy context. So like, you know, one of the characters is a fairy godmother, which is a job you can have, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But like, it's really funny, but it's also really well done as a fantasy story and a revenge story and great characters. So that one's great. And I also really adored Thornhedge, which is a sort of novella she wrote about. It's also sort of fantasy inflected.
That's on my list.
Thornhedge is like the story of like Sleeping Beauty, but kind of from the perspective of the fairy that cursed her, you know? And it's a weird inversion, but it's also just like really good characters which carry it off and make it feel real. So I love her work. She's great. Looking forward to checking that one out too. So thank you so much for joining us on this episode of The Short Game. You can find our show on the internet at shortgame.fm, which is where you'll find all the links and buttons and links to our socials and everything. The show is on Mastodon and Blue Sky. I'm also on both of those. You can find the links on shortgame.fm. I have been Reagan Kelly.
I'm Nate Heininger.
And I'm Shane Kelly.
Oh, and I didn't say thank you to our patrons. Thank you, patrons. This show is made possible by our Patreon. That's also linked on shortgame.fm. And if you become a patron of this show, you get access to our Discord community, where we talk about the games that we're playing, what's coming up on the show. You get episodes a little bit early, and you get our eternal thanks. We really do appreciate our patrons. Yes. It makes the show possible. Thank you to our patrons. And again, thanks so much for joining us on this episode of The Short Game.